You are listening to the Diesel Powered Podcast, the voice of Diesel Punk, brought to you by Comic Bento. Get a mystery box of comics and graphic novels in your mailbox every month. $50 worth at least, guaranteed, for less than 20 bucks. Visit mycomicbento.com for more. Also brought to you by Audible. Get a free audiobook on us at audibletrial.com/dieselpoweredpodcast. And now, it's time for the Agent Carter Roundtable. Hey there, all you hip cats, cool kittens, you guys and dolls, you diesel-powered disciples of cool. This is the Diesel-Powered Podcast, the voice of Diesel Punk, and this is the Agent Carter Roundtable for the final episode, the finale of Agent Carter, A Hollywood Ending. This is John Pica, your host of the Diesel-Powered Podcast, and joining me tonight will be Daisy O'Dare from Memphis, Charles A. Cornell from Michigan, and Ken Sharkey Braden from New Orleans. Also joining us tonight is our Diesel Powered Podcast co-founder, the boss, Larry Amiet. And we're going to pick up a few minutes in. We had a couple of technical problems, and so we're being joined by Larry, and you're going to join us in the middle of the conversation. Really, you haven't missed much other than the introductions. So without further ado, this is the Diesel Powered Podcast Agent Carter Roundtable for the finale of Agent Carter, A Hollywood Ending.
The two previous weeks. So either have it as the third.
Hey,
there's
Larry.
There's Larry Amiet.
Hey, guys.
Hey, Larry. Welcome to the Agent Carter Roundtable.
Thank you.
You caught Charles in mid-sentence. So let's, Charles, finish your thought.
Yeah, I was just saying that rather that it either had to end on a two-parter or move those two-parters to the end. You know, it just didn't seem, I don't know what they were trying to do by putting two-parters, because I was surprised to see two-parters. In the first place, and then when they ended the finale with only one episode, again, I think it was sort of anticlimactic in that way. Because, you know, we started talking about the Diesel Punk aesthetic, and to me, that's what, because I've watched it again, and that's what really gets you, I think, is the production values and the visual values. And I think they would have left a better lasting impression of the end of the season had we got more to see. That was the whole point of the two-parter. You got to see more. The plots in those two-parters move very quickly, but they change scenes a lot. They had lots of great special effects. They got lots of great costumes, you know, movie sets, etc. And then in the final series, it's almost like you only got. It's like having a sundae with only one scoop of ice cream, you know.
Well, and from a marketing standpoint, Charles, that did have an adverse effect. The finale had the lowest live view ratings of any episode of the two seasons. And I think,
really?
Yeah, and I think it's probably because there was that reverse psychology going on. Well, hey, we've just come off two mega two-part episodes, and it's just an hour finale. I don't think anyone in their mind thought, well, there must not be anything happening, or it must not be any good. It's just that subconscious thought. But, Larry, now that you've joined us, you know, we kind of gave our overall thoughts about this episode. We haven't dug into any details yet. But, you know, we recapped that it certainly fit our definition of Diesel Punk on the podcast. And for me, this was actually one of my favorite episodes, mostly because of the dialogue, but also because from a Diesel Punk aesthetic,
it had everything I wanted. It had that sci-fi retrofuturism. It had the high adventure. It had the witty, snappy dialogue. And it had a classic surprise. Well, it had a classic, you know, bow tie ending, but then the cliffhanger.
It had a Hollywood ending.
Yes.
It did have a Hollywood ending. Now, I do agree. It seemed to me that they needed to have stretched out and fleshed out Whitney Frost's obsession. And the fact that her gangster boyfriend went so quick from 0 to 60 and, well, she's off her rocker. I've got to save her. I thought that went a little fast. I thought the witty dialogue was fantastic in that finale. It was so many good one-liners and a little snappy. It's always good, I think, when Howard Stark. I think he's one of the best characters in the series. It's always good when he's involved. It was exciting. It was fun. Good timing, like when Frost got ran over by the car. that was great. You know, it was good. I mean, I could pick apart little details, and I mean, we can critique maybe here a little while.
And that's what we're going to do.
And what we dislike, too. I think Charles made a very good point. I think the ending, I was really shocked to see it was only 1 hour. And I think they rushed it. And that was a little disappointing to me.
I kind of felt like, first of all, I hate roller coasters in real life. But, mm-hmm. You know, I've compared this show to a roller coaster ride a lot of times. And it really felt like at the end of this ride, we came to an abrupt stop. And you're like, wait, that's the end of the ride? I want more, yeah. Which from an entertainment standpoint, the adage always leave them wanting more is definitely true here. It left me wanting more in both a good way and a bad way. You know, I felt like it was a little bit too short, but you know, I was still satisfied, but I still wanted more, if that makes sense.
Yep, of course.
Question for you, John. Do you think that maybe one of the reasons why this finale had such a low live view is because of the uncertainty of a season 3? So why watch a finale that might possibly have a cliffhanger if you are not possibly going to get your next season?
You know, that's a good point. And so I was going to leave that discussion to the end, but let's just talk about it right now. We'll just go ahead and get that out there. They did announce before this episode that the series was not going to be renewed. There were several news sources reporting that. One of them coming from an unnamed source at ABC. We knew that Hallie Atwell had already been cast on another drama. And so it looked pretty certain that there wasn't going to be another season. And then this episode has its lowest ratings, and so the conversation of ratings came up again. And you know, I'm amazed that ABC or any network for that matter is still looking at the live view Nielsen ratings to determine the success of a show or not. When you've got Hulu and DVR, TiVo, in so many different ways, iTunes to consume television and movies, you know, that old-fashioned Nielsen rating system, I just don't understand how it applies. And I don't see how they can judge the success of a show by, you know, those live views. I think it's an outdated system. And so, but in this case, I think it definitely hindered the viewership for the finale. And look, let's face it. They didn't know last season that they were going to do a second season. It was originally just an 8-part miniseries special event. It was such a big hit that they said, hey, let's do another one. And I think they kind of went into season 2 hoping for season 3, but not necessarily pinning, you know, their plans on it. But I will say that the way this episode was written, it certainly ended like they are anticipating a season 3. And there are too many loose threads, and there's too much of a cliffhanger on this final episode not to follow this up in some way. And I think the fans like us are really going to be vocal about that. But you guys, you know, what are your thoughts about that? What do you feel about the rating system and the future?
Oh, it's an absolute relic. You know, it's a relic of time. You know, they should really be getting with the program and seeing how people are watching it through things like Hulu and stuff like that. Because I've been watching it through Hulu every time, because a lot of times Tuesday evenings I haven't been able to get to the TV. So, yeah, they really need to take a look at all these different ways that people can watch their shows and take all that into consideration instead of just saying, oh, well, not enough people were in front of the TV at 8 p.m. on Tuesday to justify renewing this show.
Yeah, and I actually watched it on my iPad on the ABC app that you can connect to through your cable system, right? So you have to have a cable subscription, and then ABC allows you to link to their episodes. And I thought I really enjoyed doing that, and it allowed me to do it whenever I wanted. And so, you know, we've talked about different methods. Hulu is obviously sort of bypassing cable. There's direct cable where you can watch it. I DVR'd it. I watched it again on my DVR. You can watch it on demand. You can watch it on an app. Like, what's the big deal, whether you're watching it live or not?
And, you know, Xfinity, Comcast Xfinity on demand, they report to Nielsen on-demand views, but only for the first 5 days. So any views that happen after the first 5 days aren't even recorded.
Yeah, that's the problem. This,
we're seeing something similar in radio. There was a study a few years ago that said that the normal way of judging ratings for radio was extremely out of date. I mean, I'm sure everybody here does like I do. They channel surf. The moment, you know, you hear music, they go to ad, boom, you're hitting redial. You're hitting, you know, changing the dial, boom, and speed dial. And there, they, of course, the radio industry said, oh, no, this can't be correct. And the reason why, dollars. At the moment, if nobody's hearing the ads, because they're going from channel to channel surfing, then they lose, obviously, the advertiser is going to back off and going to want either a cheaper rate or not advertise at all. And I think television is the same way. As long as they stick with Nielsen, where everybody's, you know, supposedly watching it live, people are therefore seeing the ads, they think. But if you're watching it on DVR like I do, so you can fast forward through the ads, they're not making the money. And if that gets out, then advertisers are going to want to cut back either prices and or their advertising overall.
But there is an equality between all the programs, right? So if that were true, then every program would suffer the same ratings drop. And I don't think that's what's happening.
What I
think we're talking about here is not the method of delivery, but who's watching it, what demographic's watching it. And I think, Johnny, I think what you're talking about is a younger demographic tends to go for the non-live event. And the older demographic, like me, we tend to think, oh, you know what? We always watch our news at 6:30. That's when news is. You know, we're programmed from childhood over 45, 50 years to think that way. Whereas the new demographic's like, hey, I missed Agent Carter. It's no big deal. I can get my app. I can do watch my phone. I can do it on an iPad. I don't have to do. I can go to my friend's house. So, you know, I think that's what the problem is that anything that's maybe avant-garde is going to have a problem in classical viewership. The numbers are not going to come through in the classical way they measure it. And I don't know how they deal with that, because they're going to lose their originality and creativity if they just keep, you know, focusing it back to the old way of doing it.
Yeah, and you know, I wish there were a good answer for that, because you know, Netflix, for example, they don't report ratings at all. Hulu does. They report, I think it's quarterly, so we won't know what the actual viewership and download on this will be until you know, sometime this summer. But Netflix, they don't share that data with anybody for anything. And you know, we're seeing more and more original series, Netflix original series, Hulu original series. If you guys aren't watching 11/22/63, holy cow, what a great show! Talk about diesel punk, you know, time travel stuff. But, you
Man,
know,
Man in the High Castle.
Yeah, on Amazon. And you know, I don't know, guys. Because I've got to tell you the truth. I mean, I know a lot of people who are into really great TV. And in my circle of friends, which is a relatively small circle, you know, there's a handful of people who've watched Man in the High Castle, but it's not obviously had the huge commercial, you know, mass success that a network TV show has, but yet it's one of the projects that Amazon has continued to promote and talk about, and you know, I keep seeing people talk about it. The great thing about the new delivery methods, too, is that it's evergreen, meaning that because you don't have to be at your TV on Tuesday night at 7 o'clock, that TV show can live on for weeks, months, and even years, and new people are finding it every day. I don't know what the answer is. Ken, your thoughts on that?
I mean, you guys have basically said everything I feel. I mean, I've been watching it mostly on Hulu, and that's also because I too, you know, haven't been able to get to the TV, you know, Tuesday night, especially when you're on vacation.
Yeah.
I don't know. The way that we've seen this wrap up, hearing the interview that they did with Haley Atwell, where she came out and said that apparently ABC told her that if there is a third season, that they would work around her schedule with the other show that she's going to be working on, does give me a little hope. But you know, I'll be honest with you. I don't really trust major networks. I don't know what's going through their heads. I don't even think most people working for the major networks know what's going through their heads. I mean, I'll be honest. There is no excuse, and I will be one of those brown coats, straight up, that will say there is no excuse for shows that have had major success even after they have been canceled for major networks not to go back to them. And I'm citing Firefly on this one. I mean, Firefly, which has probably one of the most ravenous, crazy, you know, diehard group of fans out there, haven't seen anything. You know, a fan base that was almost willing to start a Kickstarter to buy it from Fox to give it back to Joss Whedon. You know, I can't explain it. I don't know why networks do what they do, to popular shows that, I mean, per example, when I was at Wizard World back in January, the amount of young ladies that I saw dressed as Agent Carter, I mean, that alone should tell the networks, people love this. People are watching it. But they don't care because it's all about the bottom line. It's about you know, making the bucks.
Well, of course, that's a good point. I'm sorry, I cut you off, Ken.
No, that's fine.
It's a very good point.
It's sad, you know. I mean, because they give us this content, they make us fall in love, you know, and then they rip our hearts out. And
how do you really feel about it, Ken?
Well, do you want this to be a 2-hour podcast, John? No, but you know where I'm. You know what I'm saying.
No, I feel you.
Of course, you know, you mentioned about all about the money. Well, remember, we are talking commercial television here.
I know.
And it is all about the money. Now, of course, this is not something new. As hardcore Trek fans, we still lament the 3 seasons of all we got was Trek back in the 60s. And they dumped it in the, you know, on Friday nights when nobody was watching. And back then, Nelson really was the only, live TV was it. So they have a history of taking shows that turns out the people loved, but for whatever reason, the executives had this idea that, well, it's not popular, it's not making us money, so we're going to dump it. I think what we're seeing here is not anything new by any stretch of the imagination.
Well, and I'll just add that there are a couple of rays of hope. Sharky mentioned the interview with Haley Atwell. There have been a couple of contradictory articles online that, yes, it is coming back for a third season. But the real ray of hope, if they do decide that they want to do a season 3, is that Disney and Marvel, obviously they own ABC, Disney does, but they have another distribution system that has been a huge success with Netflix.
I was just thinking that.
With Daredevil and Jessica Jones and all of the enthusiasm for Iron Fist and The Punisher and Luke Cage coming up, it would be very easy to slide Agent Carter another, 8-part event or whatever into that Netflix distribution system. So there you have it. I would like to see one more season. I don't think they need to go past a season 3. This is where I think a lot of shows make the mistake of going too long and, being around a little bit too long. I feel like this one would be perfect in 3 acts, so to speak. So I would like to see a season 3, but nothing beyond that. But that's my personal taste.
And I've said this before. For me, for this to be wrapped, would be what we saw in the Captain America additional content, in which we see Peggy Carter get the phone call from Howard that he is starting the SHIELD initiative and wants her to start it. And that would,
that's the logical ending.
That's the logical ending, because technically we've seen that. They can show that again, or at least allude to it. And they've kind of alluded to it this season little bit more, but
they've left it wide open for that short to fit into the continuity now.
Right, but they left this season with too many questions. They've left too many loose ends at the end of this one to just let it go.
Okay.
But then again, yeah.
So we're going a little bit backwards, and that's okay. Let's mix it up for the final episode here.
We're 40 minutes in, and we haven't started talking about the episode yet.
Well, that's okay. Let's talk about those loose ends. So we're 40 minutes in, and if you guys haven't seen the final episode, this is your spoiler warning, your spoiler alert. A couple of things. One of the loose ends is what happened to Dottie Underwood? Where did she go?
Yeah, I mean, she just completely disappeared. They used her, and then they used her for what they had to do, and then she's gone.
She escaped, right? So
right, she escaped.
Charles, she's still out there.
Yeah, and that's, you know, when I look at this, I look at a number of the subplots and what are the resolutions. And, you know, we can go through in order what the scenes were, but we have everything resolved except that. That is now left, as the ending is left, to ponder a future season. So I don't necessarily see that as a problem, because she was basically a device that they used to kind of get from point A to point B. She did her job, everything was successful, and then they created a very clever little scene where she escaped. But there wasn't anything to resolve with her. She had no conflict with another character. I mean, her repartee between herself and Peggy was something to behold. That was one of the highlights of the entire season, for sure. But there's nothing to resolve. You don't want them to be friends. You always want them to be enemies. So there's nothing to resolve. So leaving her fate unresolved is not an issue with me.
Okay. Well, how about this for a loose end? Ken, the key.
Oh,
is this an uber geek moment?
Or no. I want to, you know, Ken and I had this discussion about the club and the pins earlier in the season. And so now, you know, Thompson discovers that the pin that Dottie had stolen and that Vernon had recovered was not just a pin, but a key. So what, a key to what? And Thompson obviously left that in Peggy's charge, so that's another loose end. Go ahead, Sharky.
I just realized I've been totally freaking out along with you saying this, and my mic was off. I don't want to vape on the air. And that totally ties into Dottie. I mean, that was what Dottie was after. That was what Dottie was thinking. And we see that it is actually what she said to Agent Carter that it was. It is actually a key. It's not just a symbolism of something. It's a key. And that's it. That's all we saw. And I'm like,
Yeah. When I went back and watched that scene where she's talking to Peggy in the cell, mm-hmm. and I went back and watched it a second time after watching it all the way through and picking back up, it's like, oh, Jesus said that whole detail right there. Maybe it's the key to the whole situation. Oh, duh. Yeah, that was a good point, Ken. Very good. I like the way they did that.
And there is also something else that is mentioned that, I mean, I guess, you know, and this might tie into this key, is that Stark keeps mentioning Peru.
Yeah, that
was interesting. Does anyone, because I actually had to look it up myself, because he was like, okay, this has been mentioned multiple times now in the show. Does anyone watch Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.?
Yes.
Do you remember what they find in Peru?
Yeah, the Inhuman City.
Well, they also find the Tesseract weapon that Hydra scientists that escaped Germany were creating.
Oh. I'll need to go back and look at that. Well, uh-huh. So that's the next loose thread, right? Is Stark's new project in Peru.
And what if the key ties in to all this also in Peru? See, this is there's so many things that could possibly tie in together that they just kind of
Well, I don't think they dropped it. I think they you know intentionally left it open for us to have this conversation. For fans to be going, but wait, there's more.
Yeah.
Larry, this episode in a lot of ways reminded me and made me feel the way I felt when I watched the final episode of HBO's Carnival.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, God.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they thought they were going to get a third season.
Right.
Of that, and they got kind of just, you know, it had already been written, and most of it had been shot, and they thought it was coming down, and HBO said, nah, thanks, you know, so long, thanks for all the fish.
But I had the same feeling watching this episode.
You had to bring up Carnival. Thanks, man.
There's another one for you, Ken.
Thanks, John.
Okay.
I'm gonna finish off this podcast. I'm gonna go in the corner in a fetal position and cry. Thank you, guys. Good night.
That's a good point. It's a good point. Yeah, Carnival ended with that cliffhanger too. It's like no, so many like Ken's been talking about loose ends. At the end of that one too. You keep waiting. Somebody at least write a novel or something to bring it all together. And maybe it'll do that. Maybe somebody will write an Agent Carter novel that will be the equivalent of a season 3.
Ooh. Or, hey, maybe a comic book that you can all talk about on the other podcast.
Maybe.
Yeah, it could happen. All right, so let's talk about the big cliffhanger. We're going backwards here, but that's okay. So everyone listening, this is your spoiler alert. If you've not seen the episode yet, stop right now. Go watch it, and then come back. You've been warned.
Yeah, and then call ABC and let them know that you watched it, apparently, because I don't know what you're supposed to do. send them a carrier pigeon.
So, the big cliffhanger, we think everything's been wrapped up. Anna and Edwin Jarvis are back together. She's healthy, wealthy. You know, they're good. Peggy and Sousa, spoiler alert, they consummate their relationship, or, well, not consummate, they end in a passionate embrace and kiss, and you know where that's going. They've got
Hollywood ending.
Yeah, they've got Howard's bungalow available, and so we thought that was the end of the series, right? Everything was tied up in a nice, cute little Hollywood ending bow. And then.
And don't forget that the romantic music carries forward into the ending scene.
I did not catch that.
Yes, I watched it again. I thought, this is cool. They've got this, I don't remember the song, but it's one of these old-time romantic, old-time movie songs. And it's going through into the scene that you're now going to describe, John, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So, and leading up to this, we've been saying all through season one, all through this season, that there was something else going on with Agent Thompson. I kept expecting him to whisper the words "Hail Hydra" at some point. And in this season, he was playing playing that loyalty thing. We never knew exactly where his loyalties fell until this very last episode. And now he has cemented himself in our hearts as the good guy. You know, they've made us invest in his character, whether we disliked him or liked him. And then, after everything's tied up with a cute little ribbon, it switches to Thompson's hotel room. He's finishing packing. He's talking to someone on New York, you know, on the phone in New York. You know, hey, they're kicking me out. You hear the knocking on the door. They're pounding on the door. Hey, hold your horses. I'm coming. He opens the door. And you see the barrel of a gun with a silencer, and he gets shot point blank range in the chest, and
it looked like in the heart. I mean, it looked like there was no recovering from that.
No, I agree. It was a little bit right of the heart. It was towards his right shoulder, but it was straight through the chest. And that was a fatal shot, I believe. I believe Agent Thompson has been assassinated. And the assassin, we never see his face. All we see is his black clothes, the black gloves, the gun in his hand. He walks over to Thompson's suitcase. Singular mind. He knew what he was there to get. Picks up the classified file on, or maybe falsified file, on Agent Carter, turns around and walks out. So who is the assassin? First of all, we end on this huge cliffhanger. That's the last thing we see in this series is Agent Thompson's dead body bleeding out on the floor.
I think it's Vernon Masters. We never found his body. He mysteriously disappeared, and he has a beef with Carter.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. See, I just assumed that Vernon had bit the dust in the Zero Matter explosion with Wilkes and Whitney Frost, but that's a good theory. You know, I was looking at the assassin's collar. He didn't have a tie. He wore an open collar, mm-hmm. And the only other guy we saw in this season that had an open collar like that was Hugh Jones. But does he have it in it to be an assassin?
I don't know.
I definitely think it was one of the survivors on the council. You know,
I would agree.
But I have to admit, I'm kind of with Larry on that. You know, we didn't see what happened to Vernon after the explosion, and I'm pretty sure had they really wanted to put across that he was done with, they would have stepped over his body, or, you know, you would have seen him laying there while the dark matter was gathering, very, you know, Terminator-ish.
Ken, why would they have done that? Every other time we've seen someone encounter Zero Matter, other than Wilkes or Frost, they're turned into that liquid black ice and absorbed into the Zero Matter.
Right, except that Frost didn't complete absorbing Vernon. She was interrupted by Wilkes.
But he explodes with Zero Matter everywhere. I mean, I would just assume that Vernon would be caught in that energy, and it would have vaporized him and absorbed him into that energy. That was my thought.
Well, yeah, but she had Zero Matter in her, so she could take the blow of the concussion.
Right.
Of the Zero Matter, so she could. Now, we don't know. There's a lot of rubble all around there. He could have been buried under a lot of rubble, knocked out, and then crawled out after she, you know, came stomping out of the facility. So
she was.
It might have been. What was his name? Hugh. The
Hugh Jones, I think, was his name.
Jones. Yeah. He very resourceful. I hadn't thought about him.
Go ahead, Charles. You keep wanting to pipe in there.
Well, you know, I'm not sure that it matters what happens next, because here's where I was coming from to try to wrap up season two. What I looked at was the progression from season one. If you look at season one, for example, what we've got is a whodunit. And we start out with a mystery. Who's stealing this technology? Then we add the elements of a thriller to it. We say there's a ticking bomb going on. This technology is dangerous. Don't stop them. Then, you know, bad things are going to happen. That's what's called a mystery thriller. I wrote a mystery thriller with exactly that kind of arc. And so that, and then we positioned Peggy Carter's character in that. She outwits her colleagues, and she outwits the villains. So what we've got is a detective mode, you know, this retro detective, and what I would kind of call it, I describe season one as the Maltese Falcon meets retro James Bond. Okay? So if you got that image of what season one was about. So here's season two, and the vibe is completely different. It's no longer a whodunit, but a what is it, right? You start out by, like, you know, what is this zero matter? In fact, you don't even know it's called zero matter for the first little while, for the first few episodes. And then the thriller is more of this sort of higher level ticking bomb. Like, this is not just going to destroy the heroine. This is going to destroy the world. So this is where, you know, I've been commenting a lot about this is an amazing story. This is the retro amazing story. I would characterize this as being kind of Buck Rogers meets Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho. That's the vibe that I get from season two. So when we're starting to speculate on a potential season three and what are the elements that have been left outstanding and to speculate on, I don't care. And the reason is because I want to see what they're going to do with how they're going to frame it. Season one was the mystery thriller. Season two was the sci-fi adventure, the amazing story. What can they do with season three? You know, what's left to do? And, you know, when we talk about being Dieselpunk advocates, fans, obviously, and analysts, which is our panel here is a panel of analysts, we've seen all the Dieselpunk elements, all the retrofuturism baked into both seasons, and it's been marvelous to watch. It really has. And so what I'm more interested in is saying, well, what have they not explored in Dieselpunk? Like, and what theme have they not explored? We've got the immediate post-World War II, the misogynistic society theme in season one. In season two, we've got the sort of Soviet era atomic punk coming in with the hint of a shadow government, this sort of industrial military complex of the late 50s, early 60s. I mean, to be honest with you, it's almost as if they could fast forward this thing beyond the 50s into the 60s and have an older Agent Carter, you know.
Well,
I don't know. I'm speculating there, but do you get where I'm coming from?
Yeah.
It's not so much the individual elements as the overall theme. They've taken that mystery thriller and they've hooked us, and then they've taken the amazing story and they've wowed us. They wowed us with some great special effects, and all throughout the script writing's been great. It's been witty. We've got character development. And I got a comment to make later because I don't want to monopolize things, but I found Agent Carter's superpower. You've always heard me say that she's only human. She's not a superhero, but I found her superpower in the last episode. So now what's left to do? And I'll leave it to you guys to speculate on what's left to do because you're in the Marvel Universe in total and you're uber geeks and I'm kind of like a junior geek.
Well, I'll throw in there first. There was a great series that Marvel did, an Agent Carter series called Operation S-I-N, Sin, which was the foundation of S.H.I.E.L.D. Placed against the space race. And it took place in the late 50s, early 60s. Howard Stark and Peggy Carter forming S.H.I.E.L.D. together with Dum Dum Duggan and some other characters. So you know, whether they make that Marvel Cinematic Universe canon or not is another question, but that's one direction they could go. We've seen hints of the kind of James Bond spy type of feeling with the movie Ant-Man in the opening scenes of Ant-Man. It's the early 80s, but definitely have that element of, you know, the covert elements of S.H.I.E.L.D. And Peggy Carter and Howard Stark were very prominent in that whole arc in that movie. So I think there are a lot of things to explore. What they decide to do, I don't know. It's anybody's guess.
Well, in that interview where Haley Atwell mentioned that ABC would allow her to work both shows, Charles, she did mention that she would like to possibly see a return of Carter at a different time period, mm-hmm. maybe older. So there you go.
Yeah, I kind of read into that too. I think it's open. I don't think they really know. And as you said earlier, Johnny, that, you know, they maybe have been caught off guard by the Agent Carter season one being so successful, and you know, oh shit, we got to do an Agent Carter season two now, and then what are we going to do? And then they've sort of, you know, I think they've really done a great job in not replicating. They changed venues. They went from New York to L.A. They changed the whole dynamics of the plot from a mystery to a science fiction amazing story, and then kept all the characters in play and developed these subplots. Okay, so now what do you do?
Russia. They got to go to Russia. Or mm-hmm. Eastern Europe.
Yeah,
or,
but
the Cold War stuff starts.
The Cold War. Well, the Cold War stuff kind of started a little bit with the Leviathan. You know, maybe that's what they need to explore more, this Leviathan thing. But, you know, what I'm thinking, too, is that, you know, Dieselpunk to me is always about what could have been, not necessarily what was. And, you know, they created Hydra as a sort of an uber-Nazi organization without calling it Nazi Germany. They called it Hydra. You know, they had the Red Skull. It was, you know, it was over the top, believably, plausibly over the top. And now they created the Leviathan and it's disappeared. They created Dottie and she's disappeared. And it's like almost as if they, and then this Council of Nine that we've been talking about all season, it became Whitney Frost, and now Whitney Frost is just some lunatic in a straitjacket, right? So where did the Council of Nine go when she's gone? So they do need to really think through how they're going to weave all these things together. Leviathan, Council of Nine, and Hydra, I think, are the three. They are the specters of this series, right? The James Bond always had Spectre to deal with and the leader of Spectre to deal with. Now they've got these organizations. Which one are they going to pick? How are they going to do it? What age are they going to, you know, era are they going to put it in? They're going to advance it another 10 years? 20 years? Yeah, it's going to be fun to see.
Yeah,
if we ever get there.
Well, let's actually talk about some elements of the episode.
Yeah, let's do that.
Daisy,
I know what Carter could do.
What?
She could go to South America to find a crystal skull and fight aliens.
Oh wait. You know, I would love that. I might be
aliens.
Look,
bring aliens into it.
Well, that was some aliens. That was one of the plot points of Operation Sin, the graphic novel, the miniseries for Marvel, was that there was a Flash Gordon type character who had been gone and came back to Earth, and his arrival back on Earth is what sparked the space race. In this series, so
was he also the father of Star-Lord?
No.
Oh, okay.
I don't think so. No, maybe. I don't think so. Anyway, so Daisy, you've been chomping at the bit.
Well, I mean, I've just been ready to discuss this episode and all the stuff that happened in it. So, now we've been doing a lot of talking and we've been doing a lot of speculating, so where are we exactly in the episode right now?
We're at the end.
At the end.
So, okay. Look, here's where we are right now. It's kind of open range right now.
Yeah.
Well, let's start with the beginning. Let's start with the second to the last episode. You see the big push of the goo coming out of Wilkes, and then they fade to black, and then we start this episode 60 right. seconds before.
Did anybody notice that the recap at the beginning of this one was really long? I mean, they recapped the whole season.
I like that.
The whole thing.
I like that, though. Yeah.
It was a good thing, but they recapped the whole season for us at the beginning of that one. Well, no, I have things to say about things that happened at certain points in the series, but you guys are having a pretty heated discussion. So.
Well, Daisy, go ahead and lead us off. Jump in there, Daisy. Yeah.
Okay. Well, when we started, there were like three people that had guns pulled on people. Agent Carter had a gun on Jack Thompson, who was holding the detonator to the bomb that was going to kill Jason and Whitney and all of them in the building before the Zero Matter could get unleashed. He wanted to just nip it in the bud and finish it right there. And Peggy threatens him with that gun. And I don't remember if it's in this scene or in that one where Thompson said he didn't think she would really do it, but she cocks the gun and shows him that she means business.
Yeah, she says, not anymore, Jack. I'll do what needs to be done.
He's been one of those characters where you're never entirely sure whose side he's been on. So by that point, I could kind of understand why Peggy's ready to shoot him if she has to. Then again, that could be, Peggy's always wanting to do what she feels is right. That could have been that too. But yeah. Now, does he press the detonator before that explosion happens, or did the explosion happen without him?
Well, it doesn't. It doesn't explode. he never.
There isn't a big explosion.
Well, it's the Zero Matter being released right. by Dr. Wilkes, and that creates that Zero Matter explosion that we were talking about before, and. Jason is made whole. He's gotten rid of the Zero Matter. He's back to normal. But Whitney is absorbing all of the pooling Zero Matter.
Yeah.
And they realize right away, we got a problem. We got to go.
Yeah, the effects of the Zero Matter. I thought that was a really cool effect to see it all just kind of coming into her. And she says, she gives him a little smile and says, everything is where it belongs.
Yeah, that was good. Although I will say this is the first part, I think it started out as a low point to me. I thought that was anticlimactic, him expelling the Zero Matter. I mean, he's been talking about, I'm dangerous, you got to get me out of the city. And the worst thing he does is that he projectile vomits the Zero Matter right in the presence of Whitney Frost. It's like, of all the places for you to be, if you're going to do that, that's the worst of all places, and that's the worst that he does. He spews it out. And to me, I thought he was going to, when you see that big bush that he was, transforming into something, truly dangerous that he'd get warning about. Maybe we could have a Frost-Wilkes, showdown. Or something.
Well, Zero Matter is... Oh, sorry.
No, you're fine.
I'm real bad at figuring out when to come in. Zero Matter is kind of a new thing And so nobody really knows what the effects are on people because Whitney and Jason are the first people to be undergoing those effects. Sure, so they don't know how it's going to affect them.
I just thought it was anticlimactic. I mean, all this build-up, I'm dangerous, and, you know. Now, don't get me wrong, I enjoyed the episode, but that was one of the low points for me.
But their exit from the building and Whitney's pursuit gave us the first of one of the best moments of the show. And Ken, you mentioned it earlier, Jarvis and Samberly behind him, you know, pulling up and running over Whitney.
And well, that was great. That was, I think, I believe that was Charles.
Send in the clowns.
But the best part of that is when, you know, Jarvis hits Frost with the car and Stark pops out of the back, you know, the back door and goes, you just hit her, two-time Oscar nominee. It's like, well, yeah, but that's not going to stop her.
Yeah, that's so cool. They're so calm about it.
And then Samberly shows up in the car afterwards. There's a really great part there, though. There is actually an historical reference when they're coming out of the building, and they're like, well, you know, where's Samberly with the car? And Susan says that's a $64 question.
Yes, yes.
Which is actually something that took place in the 1940s. It was.
Yes, it did.
Mm-hmm. Sure did.
It was one of the first TV. It was a game show with Groucho Marx.
Well, and in this scene, we see the complete transfer of the comic foil from Jarvis to Samberly. We've been talking about it the last couple of episodes, but in that scene, that torch was completely passed. Because he became the goofball.
Oh, yeah. It's just the catchphrase. Oh, that's Amberly.
So, I'm going to skip forward a little bit here, just in the interest of time, to some of the highlights, I think, that we can hit. You know, they're back at Stark's bungalow at his mansion. And I love this whole scene where they're talking about the zero matter and how, you know, Wilkes is talking about how it's, you know, a dark, depressing place and Stark is like, you know, that you give us a tear in the universe and you just say it's dark and depressing. Where's the mustard? Jarvis, are you grounding seeds?
What about mustard?
Yeah, I just love that whole exchange, and again, it points to that dialogue that Howard Stark brings, because he's such a what's the word I'm looking for, irreverent character, that he literally can say anything and let the other characters play off of it.
Yeah, but there's even a. And this was one of the low points for me in this episode. There's the part where they're in the lab, and they make the mention of how, you know, someone's trying to kill Carter, and Stark looks at Carter and says, "Well, maybe you're the problem."
Oof.
I guess they meant it to seem out of place, because you even see the expression on Jarvis. Like, Jarvis even kind of, like, takes a step back and looks at Stark like, what did you just say? But it just seemed so... It was incredibly awkward. Because it's like, dude, you've been praising this woman.
It was like a bad Oscar night joke from a couple of presenters who were trying to... you know, right? You know, there was some awkward moments. It was exactly like that.
And I just didn't get it. I was like, why would Stark say that? You know, especially at a time like this, especially after everything that he's seen Carter do.
Because he doesn't think before he speaks.
Yeah, I think Johnny hit it.
He just says whatever comes to his mouth or to his mind. There's no filter.
So he's Trump.
Yeah. Okay. That's good. But
no, I actually kind of like Howard Stark. So
I like Howard Stark, but I think Johnny still hit it. You know, there's no filter. So yeah, he's pretty cool. But then sometimes it just comes out. And
but it was just such a weird place for it for me. I guess I don't know. It kind of like it just kind of threw me out of the moment. I guess is what I'm trying to say because it was so. Yeah, it just seemed. Yeah, it was very awkward.
Well, yeah, I can see that, but the next scene kind of redeems itself, doesn't it? Because in comes Manfredi,
right.
Who you know, we kind of skip this interaction he had with Whitney, losing her mind, doing her equations in her room, you know, slapping his hand, "Don't touch me while I'm working," and you see on his face this indignant disgust and anger and worry all at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And he realizes that there's only one person that can help him, and it happens to be an old school buddy, high school, middle school, neighborhood, whatever, and that's Howard Stark. And that whole exchange when he comes in with Jarvis at gunpoint and the mustard in his hand, And they have that exchange about underwear and wearing skivvies in public, and everyone's like, "What in the world is happening right now?" And you see, it's their kind of their code language, and they're old buddies. They embrace, and for God's sake, let Jarvis put the mustard down. I just love that whole scene, and of course, it makes sense that Howard Stark would have a old buddy who is a crime lord. Of course.
It does. He has his fingers in everybody's pie. What was it Peggy said that, with Jarvis, that he gives money to every candidate so that he can, you know, he can have a, you know, in for everyone, whoever wins. So it makes sense he hedges his bet. He has he's had somebody in the underworld too.
Well, and it's not just that he's paying them off. They're friends. They're old chums.
Yeah, that was obvious.
You know, talking about how Manfredi is always going after the crazy ones. You remember so-and-so, she tried to push you up the East Street Bridge.
Mm-hmm. That implies that they were almost childhood friends.
Yes, exactly.
And I love that banter when he was talking to, when Stark was talking to Jarvis. He said, "What is it that makes... he said something effective. Make geniuses great." And he said, "By judging by you, sir, copious amount of alcohol and loose women."
Oh yeah, that's genius right there.
Hey, I'm buying that. I'll buy that for a dollar.
Hey, yeah.
a reference to another Kurtwood Smith movie. So let's talk about Manfredi for a moment. You know, this is another character that they've really made me like.
Yeah.
And we really see that he's the victim of really a tragic love. And I really feel bad for this character.
Yeah.
In these scenes leading up and then at the end, you know, when Whitney has been committed to the institution and, you know, you see the pain in his eyes. The actor does a fantastic job on this character. But, you know, he comes to Howard Stark and Peggy Carter to help him find a cure for Whitney because she's being consumed by this Zero matter. And, you know, I loved how low-tech their surveillance was. They really went into Whitney's room with no plan, right?
Yeah, they just kind of went in and just started snapping away.
And how do you interpret those pictures on the back end? Because
what you have your scientist friends for.
Well, yeah, but I mean, it looked like Sousa was just kind of snapping random, and in the dark. I was a little bit.
Have some focus.
Yeah, I was a little bit dubious of that whole process, but
did there need to be a little romantic thing there.
They've really been pushing that, haven't they?
I know, but this was another thing that caused me to go, come on, guys, right now you're going to do a cutesy. Hey, Carter, turn around so I can take a cute photo with you while we have someone who has alien goo that could, you know, suck us in.
I shouted at the TV.
Take the damn photos, get out of the room.
And they barely got out, right?
I was just saying, come on, move along, take your photos and get out.
But hey, Charles, I want to get your take on this, because that whole scene where Manfredi is using his goon as a distraction, as a diversion for Whitney, was phenomenal. I love that whole exchange.
Yes, and we're talking about Manfredi as well and his character. I thought it was really well played. And I love the great line where Wilkes says something about, well, you know, why should we help you? You're trying to kill us. And he said, mea culpa, doctor, mea culpa. It was a great godfather. He's become a godfather character in this story. At the beginning, he was just a bit of a goon, but now he's becoming this god lovable villain. You know, the Al Pacino, the Marlon Brando. You know, we loved to hate them, we hated to love them, but that's who he is. And then he gets into this thing with his. He sets this guy up to try to get Whitney Frost to delay her from re-entering the room and discovering Peggy and Sousa. And it was just classic. It was really like classic because he's like, all of a sudden it's a fake confession that turns into a real one, because the guy actually has something, you know, and it doesn't, it's not obvious. And you sort of thinking, well, okay, they're just play acting. And then all of a sudden it's like, holy shit, there's some other plot going on behind there with the guy.
I swear to God.
I love watching Manfredi's face when he started going off script, as it were.
Yeah, and he's like,
wait a minute.
And he's like, oh, damn it, now I gotta kill ya.
Yeah, exactly. He's the villain we love to hate, we hate to love. Just perfectly acted out in that scene.
I love his interaction with his grandmother. There's Nona.
Oh, Nona.
Yeah, I love her. I thought she was great, especially when she gave, you know, when he said, "Oh, and he thinks you're the devil," and she spits on the ground and gives him the devil horns at Peggy.
And you know what's interesting about
That's what she said later, right?
Yeah, I mean that character, when you actually see that character speaking Italian. It has nothing to do with her. It's got everything to do with Manfredi. He becomes a little boy at that point. That actual character placement was to develop his character as the lovable little boy who's a mama's boy, an Italian mama's boy, and who's lost in love with Whitney. And what am I going to do? I'm going to talk to my mama. It's priceless.
That, you know,
they really do a good job.
When we first met Nana, they said that she thought Peggy was the devil. And what does she tell Manfredi that he has to do if he can't let go of Whitney Frost?
Make a deal with the devil.
You gotta make a deal with the devil.
Yep.
Yeah, good point.
And I think that's what gets him to go to Carter and all of them.
So, hey, you know, I skipped over this, but I'm looking at my notes. When they were sitting out on the patio, was it Wilkes that... brought up the portraits in every room?
Yeah. Yes, thank you. Thank you for bringing that up.
Because I mentioned it a couple of episodes ago that I think that's...
I mentioned it.
Yeah, I think that's Stark's surveillance system in the house. But nobody else has brought it up until Wilkes says, what's with all the portraits in every room?
As soon as I heard that, I was like, the writers are listening to our podcast.
They might be.
And
I think it's his I simply thought it was his narcissism. You know, like,
yeah. Well, that's kind of hesitated to respond, but as Tony has said, we kind of like talked about in the podcast too, is that it would make sense as that it's also his, you know, he's got eyes behind the eyes kind of thing.
It does. It gets kind of creepy though when you're considering that Peggy's staying there, and
hey,
then it suddenly gets kind of creepy.
He is a filmmaker.
Really? We're going back to this?
Yeah, anyway. So they gather all the intel, all the notes from Whitney, dubiously, and they bring it back, and as Peggy says, three of the most brilliant minds in the world are working on this solution. And
they can't agree on what to name it.
Yeah, yeah. You got Stark, Samberly, and Wilkes. And when she says, hey, I have complete faith. I've got the three most brilliant men in the world working on this. And I loved Jarvis's line. Dear Lord, I think you can hear their egos inflating. I think what he said.
That was great.
And And then she adds that zinger. By the way, it's called a rift generator. And
that's a lot snappier than the shears of God.
Yes. it plays to that dialogue that we're talking about. And when you have all of these characters together in one place, and you have to have a tightly written script, but at the same time, the writers have given them enough leeway to let their characters shine through. And we're just getting these great moments like that. You can actually see their egos inflating. From that moment on, this episode becomes very straightforward, right? They have to build the rift generator. Wilkes comes up with the idea to use X-rays instead of gamma rays to keep it in check. Samberly is going to man the cannon and it was very straightforward. And Peggy is right. As soon as that rift opens, she says Whitney Frost is going to feel it. She's going to come, or Wilkes says that, Peggy, you know, understands that. She agrees with that. And sure enough, and this to me, Charles, was maybe one of the defining moments for Whitney Frost's character for me. She's on her hands and knees working on the project. The rift opens and she looks up in shock and horror.
Yep.
And then that grinchy grin comes across her face. Both beautiful and horrifying at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, and I don't know whether I just want to take a step back here, but one of the best lines in the whole of the two seasons is when Howard Stark is trying to bounce golf balls off the rift. Right?
Classic.
Yeah, well, that's in the next scene. Yes, it is classic.
And I actually wrote it down word for word, and here's what it said. Stark's hitting this golf ball off the rift. It's bouncing around. I don't know what he's trying to do. I think he's trying to get it in the rift, but it keeps missing. And he turns to Jarvis, and he says, what am I doing wrong, Jarvis? And Jarvis, the stoic British butler, says, sir, we are standing in front of an incomprehensible rip in the fabric of our world. Use a seven iron.
It was brilliant.
What?
I laughed out loud.
That was brilliant.
Oh, there were plenty of great moments like that in this episode.
Oh, yeah.
I think that line to me, you know, when you think about it, he's summarizing exactly where they are in the plot. We're standing in front of an incomprehensible, quote-unquote, amazing story, sci-fi thriller, rip in the fabric of the world that's going to – it's like the biggest threat the world has ever seen. And, of course, we're playing golf. And to me, that was just the best, one of the best comedic lines of the entire two seasons.
Yeah. No, I agree. I laughed out loud, and I thought that was brilliant. And look, it spoke to Stark's character again, how cool he is and how irreverent he is at the same time. Here they are facing a potential global disaster, and he's playing, and he's, you know, shooting golf balls into the rift, or trying to, and they're bouncing off the rift. And what Wilk says, I think somebody needs to get their priorities in order. And what does Stark say to that? I forget. But, you know, he kind of disregards that comment. That, like, hey, my priorities are in order. We could die right now. I'm not going to fret about it. I'm just going to go with the moment. The whole thing right there was just very cool. So, but they've got the rift open. It's open. The team is there. Oh, let me back up, because they're building the stuff at the SSR, and we see Rose, one of my favorite characters, tightening that bolt, and man, Howard was macking on her big time.
Oh yeah,
and this was one of my other favorite lines when he says, oh, and that perfume. What is that? Rinso.
It's Rinso.
It was brilliant. It was fantastic. And I loved it that Howard was into Rose. I think we all kind of fell in love with her, didn't we?
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. I gotta find that dress and those glasses.
Yeah. I love it that she calls him Mr. Stark, and he's like, my father's name is Mr. Stark. You can call me Howard. And then Samberly goes, can I call you Howard? No.
Yeah, it was great. It was just great. That was another great moment. So straightforward from there on out, you know, Whitney does hear the call of the Zero Matter. She shows up at the lot, at the studio. You know, I thought this was a little bit too easy, in that she's standing there in front of the rift. You know, hey, I've got the shot. Take it. They blast her with the gamma ray. It was no mess. I mean, it was that straightforward. Here we go, here we go, here we go. She expels the Zero Matter into the rift, and now they got to figure out how to close the rift. I was a little bit disappointed that the resolution with Whitney was so easy.
That's what happens when you do it in an hour, not 2 hours.
Right.
I mean, yeah, that exactly. Been,
good point.
That should have been played out.
How she came from her place to the lot so quickly. How did she get there? Who drove her? I mean, the whole Jesus appeared, and
she read a. Sorry, go ahead.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Larry. Huh?
Larry, go ahead.
Oh, okay, that's okay. No, I was just thinking. It's just that it's like she slowly walks, you know, Frankenstein, like out of the house, and suddenly she's. Does she live right next door? I mean,
she is an Oscar-nominated actress. She might live right next door, literally.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm like you. I think that scene they went a little fast on that.
She found a stray flamingo and rode the flamingo. To the studio. I'm sorry, guys. I'll leave. Bye.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's you know what's interesting is, and I, whether you guys are writing stuff, I know Johnny does, but one of the biggest challenges for a writer, honestly, is to get your characters from one place to the other, mm-hmm. without being sort of like, you know, obvious. And they set this thing up so that, yeah, she can she will know. You know, Wilkes says something around, well, you know, I was consumed by zero matter, and believe me, if there's zero matter, if the rift opens, I'll know where it is, kind of thing. That's the implication. I think they didn't really explain it that well, but the implication is that if you're in that mode, you'll know where the rift is, and it'll draw you like the North Pole, magnetic North Pole, which is great. But here's what the problem was. The problem was, think about every downfall of every major villain in cinematic history. You want to stretch this sucker out. You want to, you know, you want the person watching or reading to actually apply that last twist of the knife, because you built this villain up and you want them to feel the satisfaction of the ending, the resolution and the climax. And they didn't do that. They just, like, it was like zap and she's done. She's toast. I mean, yeah, they sort of played around with the science of it and talking about X-ray containments, and, you know, they put some comedy in it to, you know, like Peggy finally walks out and tells her it's a rift generator, you know, it's a comedic thing. And it's all sort of preparing us for what's going to happen. But when it actually happens, it's too darn quick.
That's a real good point, Ken. That kind of gets back to the way it opened to me. It was too, just, blah. Oh, zero matter's gone. I mean, all the guy really needed was some Alka-Seltzer. Could have solved the whole problem early on. And now, like you just pointed out, she walks in, walks up, got a direct shot, bang, she's done.
And she's very convenient. Very conveniently in exactly the right place without having to move the gamma ray gun anywhere, right? It's like she steps right in front of it. Oh, you want me here? Where's my mark? You know? Okay, great. I'll turn my back. You press the button. I'm toast.
Well,
remember, the episode is called Hollywood Ending. Yeah. So maybe it's going with the whole everything works together perfectly in Hollywood movies, yeah, kind of thing.
Well, and really, Ken, I think you and I, as a writer, we know that Whitney, at least in this episode, the resolution with Whitney wasn't really the climax. They needed a device to get to the real problem, which was, how do we close the rift? And putting Sousa in that place to be the sacrifice. And you know, bringing the whole, because all throughout this series, season one and season two, Sousa is continually rescued by Peggy. And mm-hmm. And here they've put him in that place again. And it's not in a way that diminishes him as a character or diminishes him as a masculine character. Because every other indication is that Sousa can handle himself, even, you know, on a crutch. But, you know, it's kind of the dynamic of their relationship. She's the white knight. And so, you know, they have to close the rift. They're arguing about who's going to do it. And Sousa just takes it on himself. He ties the hose around his waist. And when they, by the time they notice that, who is it that says, oh, that's no fair at all?
Oh, I don't know, but I know how I just love how they've all been just arguing about who gets to go, and meanwhile, Sousa's just kind of gone.
Yeah, and you know, I think, you know, while that whole dilemma was to bring some closure, resolution, further define the relationship between Peggy and Sousa, the real purpose of that scene was to show Stark's ultimate victory in creating the flying car.
Thank you.
Yeah, he finally got it to work.
Or, as we've seen in another Marvel series, the early rendition of Lola.
Yes.
Lola?
Well,
Lola is Agent Coulson's, what, 1960?
It's a Stingray convertible.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
That also is a hover car, is a flying car.
Yeah. shield flying car. Well, earlier when they were arguing in the workshop about what they were going to call this thing, you know, Stark makes mention from the first Captain America movie, hey, I built a flying car. And Sam Riley's like, yeah, but it didn't work. He's like, the first one didn't, but the second one did. And you know, kind of referencing back to that. And then Jarvis really is the one who saves the day, right? Because he realizes, hey, we've got a flying car. And we've got a gamma bomb that we can load into the car and send this car through the rift. I mean, really, truthfully, Jarvis is the hero of this entire season. What?
Men, dogs!
Dogs have very strong opinions about this episode.
Yes.
Well, so that was one of my notes, was Jarvis's character arc. And, you know, we have seen him go from kind of a very bland milquetoast in the first couple of episodes of season one to a very slapstick comedic foil, then to a very driven, vengeful character, and now, turns out, he's the guy who comes up with the solution and saves the day. And Charles, we talked about this either last week or the week before, that's been kind of a pattern that's been established throughout this season, is that Jarvis just so happens to have the right solution for the right moment. And it all culminates in this moment.
Yeah, and maybe it's a good time to talk about Peggy, because it is called Agent Carter too. And the one thing I did get out of this episode, and the one thing I really liked about this episode, was that Peggy is always there to tie everything together. And, you know, I've said before that she is human, and when she goes through her martial arts scenes, she doesn't have any superpowers, she can't break through brick walls, etc., shoot rays out of her eyes and all that kind of stuff. But she always, in the season one, her superpower was her wit and her ability to outwit. And here in this final episode, which may be her final episode, we don't know, what we see with Peggy is that her superpower is the ability to lead. She is the leader of this group. And, you know, I appreciate what you said about Jarvis, but it struck me that, you know, Peggy Carter has now come to the point where she is, what's the word for it here, using her resources, her personal charm, and her leadership to solve problems, keep a step ahead, and pull the team together. And, you know, that's what she does. Because if you remember, they're all standing around with Sousa, like Sousa's off camera, and they're all saying, well, no, I volunteer, no, I volunteer, no, I volunteer. And then we turn around and find out that Sousa's on the end of some fire hose getting sucked into the rift. Peggy's the one that steps in and leads that, leads. She's the one, first one pulling, and she's the first one to volunteer to take Sousa's place.
Yeah, that's a really good point, Charles, because how many times in this episode alone do we see Thompson kind of like bow to her? You know, when they're all in the lab, you know, putting together the device, Thompson comes in and is like, hey, I'm here to help. And she's like, all right, good, you can take the food order. And he starts to say something and immediately goes, you know what, I'm going to do that for you.
And he did it.
And he also mentions to her while they're waiting for Frost to show up that, well, I guess, how soon before, you know, when we get back to New York, do you expect me to pack my office? Because he knows that she's got him. And she's like, I'm not going to rat you out. You're a good guy. And because of that, you know, and because like you said, Charles, of her charm and her wit and her, you know, her ability to use
her
all
integrity.
That her integrity.
Her integrity, yep.
She can get people that were, you know, a couple episodes ago willing to throw her to the wolves to actually hand over important evidence and entrust her with it. And basically, at that point, I really saw that Thompson was basically handing her not only the key to, you know, the Council of Nine, but basically handing her the keys to the SSR and being like, you know what? You're absolutely, you know, you have been right the entire time, Carter, and, you know, you're right, and here you go. Whatever you need, I'm at your disposal.
Right, and we've got all the resolutions stacked up right at the end. When we split off before the rift and Whitney, which is the ultimate resolution of what happens to Zero Matter and how do we defeat Whitney, we have this interplay between Peggy and Thompson that resolves that, you know, and it was very it's like, you're a good man. That's how it was resolved, with a very, I knew I could trust you. You're a good man, and that put that to bed. Then after the major resolution of the Zero Matter and Whitney, we get one resolution after another stacked up. We get Peggy Carter and Jason resolving their love relationship. You know, we had a dance together. If things were under better circumstances, maybe things would be different, but they both realized that somehow they drifted apart. We could feel it. Obviously, they had this barrier of the Zero Matter that was preventing them from connecting physically, so that was an issue. But at the end, it was like, you know, we really had an emotional disconnect. It wasn't the Zero Matter. There's an emotional disconnect. That resolved that itself. We had Anna Jarvis. That whole subplot was resolved. You know, they're back together. Things are going to go back to normal. Jarvis is not going to let Peggy go. So we have that, you know, dynamic between those two being resolved. We've got Whitney sitting in the sane asylum with her love to hate to love mafioso coming with roses, and he can't even give her the roses because she's going to cut herself with the thorns to try to break open her skin and get the Zero Matter back in. So that was resolved. They did a terrific job of doing it. The question is, could they have done it better had it been a double episode? Because those resolutions carried, you know, many episodes on their back, right? I mean, we're talking about 8 or 9 episodes of subplot. I didn't mind it. I thought, as a writer, I could see it, and it's like, okay, good for you. They left a few hanging issues out there, which is fine. They resolved it. It was, you know, from your guys' point of view, I think, was it too fast? Could they have done a better job?
Well, I don't think those final resolutions, I think those final scenes were really just perfect to tie those up. I think it was just the overall story was a little bit too fast for a finale. But as far as those stories resolving themselves, I thought they were done perfectly. I was really satisfied with each one. I was... talking about resolutions, what we think is the final scene is Carter and Sousa in his office, and he says, "Well, that wraps up the Isodyne case. We're done." And but I got to tell you, Peggy, you messed up. And we get this little exchange here that, you know, I think. It was a double-layered exchange. I think that Sousa was speaking truth, but there was obviously a timbre and a rhythm in the way that he was doing it that progressed that relationship forward, and ultimately we see what happened. You know, Jarvis has urged Peggy, maybe there's a reason you should stay. Then Sousa dresses her down, but at the same time comes closer to her, and she responds by you know, kissing him and throwing him down on the chair and, you know, wah chicka wah wah. And well, come on, Daisy, we know where that scene's going.
We know where it's going. It's just I didn't feel like it was completely 100% necessary for it to go there, but you know.
Well, no, I think it was. I think they needed to close with them realizing that they are meant to be together. And that's what that entire scene was about.
It's just the romance thing, the love triangle thing, the should she go for Jason or Sousa thing, a lot of that, those worries felt a little bit unnecessary to me. But I guess now that she's out of the danger, she feels like it's okay to act on those feelings.
Maybe I'm just a hopeless romantic, because it just made me smile.
So am I. Yeah. But it was just, it was nice to see them together, but it still felt kind of strange. I don't know. There was something about the romance that didn't feel like it completely fit in with everything else.
Yeah. Daisy, did it feel contrived? To me, it felt like it was very quick, and it was almost as if, hey, we got to do this. We can't. You know, we're running out of time here.
We can't end the episode without them kissing.
Yes, and that's where I think the, you know, you also asked the questions about, you know, you started out by saying that they had a recap of the entire, you know, season, and one of them was of, I think, is it Violet, her name?
Yep.
His fiancé?
Yeah,
yep.
Violet, yeah.
You know, saying to him, you know, you don't love me. And, you know, we didn't really see, that resolution was too contrived. It was set up, and there wasn't enough.
It felt like
there wasn't enough angst. You need
they introduced Violet, and they kind of. I'm so sorry.
No, go ahead. Yeah, I want to.
I'm bad about that. They introduced Violet, and then they just shove her out of the way.
yeah, exactly. And you know, I think the thing is that it's like you want them to be pulled, stretched from their previous position, right? Sousa has always had this, like, you know, I got to do the right thing by my girl. You know, I mean, he must have loved her before Peggy came back came on the scene from New York. They were already a thing. They were already getting to that proposal stage. So there must have been some love there. And so now what you're trying to do is stretch the character away from that love into this, you know, choice that he has to make. And what they really did was kind of like, it was like an elastic band that broke. He just catapulted to Peggy and they embraced, you know what I'm trying to say?
Well, but
you need to really pull the characters apart and leave something behind. Like, it's not going to be that easy for Sousa to just leave her. Surely he's not that callous. And it's not going to be that easy for Peggy to have made the choice.
Well, but
I think they didn't develop it.
Well, I think that all happened off frame, off screen, in the 6 months between season one and season two, because they reference something happening with them and there being a previous relationship that, you know, took Sousa out to the West Coast. And I think we're just seeing the culmination of that, because it's been sprinkled throughout this season.
But season one ended with Carter kind of shooting down Sousa, you know. And,
yeah, but
and
6 months. There's 6 months between it. Anything could have happened in 6 months. I mean,
I know. But here, the thing is, to me, okay. Here's my thing. Carter felt like a much stronger, independent woman in the first season, and this season bothered me because it almost, it's like we've talked about, the, you know, the love triangle, and the, you know, with Wilkes or with Sousa, and it's like, I'll be very honest with you. I could have done without all the romance stuff,
Yeah, I think I know where, and I kind of get a little bit of the same feeling here. It's almost, I hate to use the word sexist, that they, because it is a female character, that they have to make a love interest involved in the, it's like they almost felt like it was, we've got to do this. It's almost, it kind of goes against the kind of the grain of the independence of the strong, independent character that Agent Carter has always been.
Go ahead, Daisy.
Well, yeah, let the woman say something about this, eh? Anyway.
Got a mansplain it to you, don't you know?
On one hand, I can kind of see what they were trying to say was that, hey, you can be a strong, independent woman, and you can have these romantic entanglements, you know? They could have been trying to say that you can be this tough, badass agent, and you can still worry about things like that because you can have it all. You don't have to be completely one way or the other. But there was something about it. It's kind of hard for me to explain, but there was something about it that if it had taken place off camera, like Johnny had said, I think we needed to at least know a little bit more about it. You know, because it did kind of, that this last scene just made me go, what?
Daisy, I completely agree with you on that. My issue is the weak in the knees kind of look she kind of got sometimes, which it to me was almost out of character.
Everybody gets weak in the knees.
No, I'm probably saying this totally incorrectly, but it was the feeling that some of it was a little too contrived, we discussed. The fact that Sousa's girlfriend immediately jumped to the conclusion that, oh, you're in love.
That I did not like. I didn't really care for.
The whole breaking of her own rule about, if in danger, do you put yourself before or after, or do you let your feelings get in the way? The longing lost looks, I understand and I totally support the idea that, you can have a strong female lead who can have everything. It's just, it wasn't written well. For some reason, to me, it just seemed, after dealing with the Carter that we dealt with in season one, I don't know. There was something about the writing that just didn't fit right. Maybe that's just me. I don't know.
Well, see, and I see that as kind of a testament to her character. She started off in the Captain America movie as a hard-as-nails military leader, helping train the troops, lead the troops, coordinate the attacks. In season one of the show, she was very guarded. She was put off. She had that kind of, I lost the love of my life, I'm never going to love again. And then, there's something happens in the 6 months between the shows. We don't know what, but she's still kind of guarded, and now we see her softening, and in this last scene, she's finally let her guard down, and she's allowed herself to be human again. I don't know. For me, as a character arc, I really liked it, but maybe that's just me.
Yeah, I think we're kind of saying what we said earlier, and that is that there was so much to do to resolve the various arcs and the various subplots that they needed 2 hours to do it, to do it justice. They did it, and it worked. It had a progression that kind of resolved all the important points, but they didn't leave us feeling committed to the resolution. When I say pulling, that Susan needed to be pulled away from his previous relationship, we didn't see any of that in that episode at all. I mean, poor old Violet, she's left to some little clip at the very beginning saying, oh, you remember her? And that's what, to me, I thought was a function of time. They couldn't get all those resolutions done and move that plot through that hour, which is really only about 45 minutes when you take the commercials out.
Well, and, you know, you mentioned Maltese Falcon earlier tonight, and I just saw that for the first time on the big screen. Fathom Events, you know, released it in theaters. I went and saw it. I had never seen it before, and... You know, as a comparison, because you brought it up and it was a good comparison, one of the hallmarks of the era that this show is set in, especially those Hollywood films, was that a lot of those character motivations were just kind of hinted at, or they were just, I don't want to say glossed over, but they weren't really... drilled in real deep. You know, they didn't dive real deep into those character layers. A lot of the character motivations were very superficial, and especially in the Maltese Falcon. One of my complaints was that I didn't really feel any of the characters' actions were motivated by anything in truth. But so from a standpoint that. You know, how this show resolved itself and those elements are very much in line with the way movies and TV were made in the era.
A Hollywood ending.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I'll just add this as my last two cents and then we can wrap up. But one of the things I love about this show is that it is so different from everything else that's on TV. Even the other, you know, kind of comic book superhero stuff. When you look at the DC stuff, the Flash, Arrow, Legends of Tomorrow, can you talk about the romantic stuff being out of place? Those shows are so full of schmaltzy junior high drama, it makes me want to blow my brains out. And then on the flip side of it, on these cop show dramas, these crime dramas, they are so dark. And they are dealing with such twisted, demented, graphic material that I think we've become very conditioned to one or the other. And to have a show that walks all of those lines without crossing any of the lines, you know, being a show that has drama, that has comedy, that has romance, that has high adventure, science fiction, and is still appropriate for everybody in the family to sit down and watch together, that's such a rare thing. And I think when we see it, you know, we have to remind ourselves that it is a different animal. Does that's that make true. Sense?
No, it does. It does. It does. It does.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, we're kind of, in a way... trying to trash something that we love. It's almost as if we want our love to be perfect because we're such fans. You know, we said originally when we did the season one roundtable, we said this isn't just about a story about Peggy Carter. This is about bringing Diesel Punk to a mass audience, and it's so important for us because we've seen this sort of herky jerky. Approach to it with Indiana Jones, and it died off, and then Sky Captain was a brilliant cinematic event, but it got nothing. It was just, it died. It never had any lasting feeling that we were going to see more of those kinds of movies or those kinds of shows. Agent Carter comes along, and wow, they wowed us. And we're so much in love with the idea of putting Diesel Punk out there as a genre. And we are now talking about our disappointments, but we need to reflect back and say it's not a perfect love. You know, it isn't a perfect love. It wasn't done perfectly, but it's still something we love.
Well, well, I never expected it to be perfect, and honestly, the good of it, the parts that I like, far outweighs any little problems I might have here and there. We're just discussing, you know.
No, yeah, I'm not criticizing us, but I'm just saying it's kind of easy to pick out the little bits, but then you sort of take the 30,000 foot look down at the landscape, and you realize how beautiful and green it is. And there are no borders, right? You don't see the border between California and Nevada. What you see are the mountains and the landscape. And that's what I think has happened here. Season one and season two, we don't see the border between them now. I like what Johnny said about bringing this element of the old-time movies in, because they were quite corny. And they didn't treat themselves completely seriously. They were kind of over the top. Some of the acting was pretty wooden. But there were some classic stuff, classic dialogue, classic scenes. There were a lot of formula. And we saw all that. But they did it in a modern take that I think appeals to a broader audience.
Well said. Any last words? We're over 2 hours. On a 45-minute episode. But there was a lot to unpack here. I don't have any last words. I'm going to leave it up to you guys, and then I'll sign us off.
Well, I just want to say, whether we get to see more of it or not, this show, I mean, I don't usually watch a lot of TV in general. Agent Carter is the first show in a while that I've been really excited about and that I've actually tried to watch when I could, when it was on. You know, I haven't felt this way about a show in a long time, going, oh, it's Tuesday, Agent Carter's on, I gotta get home to watch it, you know? I have not felt that way about a show in a long time, and it's been a great show to see. And it's been a great way where when someone asks, hey, what's Diesel Punk? I say, well, there's some on TV right now. And I have just enjoyed this show. You know, I might say things here and there about, oh, well, this thing was, you know, I didn't like how they did this thing, or, you know, this thing could have been done better. But honestly, it was great, and I love it. And I would really like to see more, but we'll see how that happens.
Larry?
Well, I think Daisy really hit upon something really important. It was a really good series. Whether or not there's going to be a third season on Netflix or ABC, whatever, these two seasons were really great. I think we've got something that we can point to. So when, like Daisy said, when people say, well, what's Diesel Punk? Did you see Agent Carter? Yeah, I love that show. Well, there you go. And it was a good ride. It was a fun show. You know, yeah, maybe the last hour was short. Well, maybe it was short because we want so much more because it was so good. And, well, I'm glad we had Agent Carter and had a great time. Enjoyed it.
Very good. Charles, Ken?
Well, I just want to say that Agent Carter, I first of all, Daisy, you absolutely nailed it right on the head. Diesel Punk, Agent Carter, they're like synonyms. You know, what is it? Agent Carter. Oh, yeah, now I know what it is. It was a perfect representation of the genre. It's going to be that way. We're going to talk about that, whether there's any more episodes or not. But here's the takeaway for me. Inspirational character in Peggy Carter. I'm writing Diesel Punk. I have a female character. It's set in that kind of era. It's set with those kinds of societal conditions. It has actually affected the way I'm writing that character. And that's how powerful their writing was and how good it was and how impressionable it was on me. And I can't thank them enough. That's all I'm going to say, because I loved every minute of it.
Very good. Ken, you get the last word.
pink flamingos. No.
Don't get me started. I'm supposed to be done.
As nitpicky and everything as I get, I absolutely adored and was thrilled by this show. Everything that it had to offer, all the tie-ins, and like, you know, what you and I have talked about, Johnny, about, you know, Agent Carter really being the kind of like the anchor in a lot of way to the greater Marvel universe. And I'm so glad that they chose such a strong female lead character to basically be that anchor, you know, for the greater Marvel universe. You guys are absolutely right. We need more television like this. We need great high adventure with sci-fi and comedy and drama and love and everything like that wrapped into good family viewing entertainment that everyone can enjoy, and something that can inspire young ladies, because like I said, seeing the amount of young Agent Carters walking around a convention nowadays is absolutely amazing. And plus, you know, for those of us who are into diesel punk and love the 30s and 40s, you know, it's nice to see that kind of period piece. And ABC, I really hope you guys, I hope you give us at least one more season. And if not, at least give us First Agent Jarvis.
Oh, man, I said I wasn't going to say anything else, but you brought up something. I'm not going to go there, but he would make a great super spy series on his own. Anyway, all right, guys, thanks for joining us once again on the round table. And Larry, thank you for joining us for our last episode. And for those of you who have only been listening to the Agent Carter round table, you may not be familiar with Larry M yet. Larry and I started this diesel powered podcast thing 4 years ago, just the two of us with a harebrained idea. And now, we are one of only two diesel punk podcasts. We're the only English diesel punk podcast. Easy for you to say, Larry. We average between 10,000 and 12,000 downloads every week now. We started, Larry, with two. It's been an amazing run.
And you and I.
Yeah, yeah. No, your dad. If you guys aren't listening to our regular diesel punk and pop culture roundtables with Larry and Daisy and myself, tune those in. They're on iTunes, on Stitcher. And this Monday, we're adding a brand new monthly music special from an electro swing DJ. The Swag Commander, Eugene John, is joining us, and he'll be bringing us a monthly show. So check that out, iTunes, Stitcher, other places that you get your podcast in for entertainment. And I just want to thank you guys again. So yeah, Daisy?
Johnny, why don't you tell them about where people could possibly meet you and me in person this next weekend?
Oh, good catch. Good catch. Yeah, this coming weekend, the 18th, 19th, and 20th, Memphis, yeah, Tennessee. We're going to be at Mid-South Con, and that's just one of my favorite cons of the year. And it's what hotel is it at, Daisy?
Oh, goodness, I believe it's a Hilton.
It's in East It's in East Memphis.
You can't miss it. It's a big shiny hotel that looks like a beer can.
Yeah, and it's got a big fountain outside. Anyway, midsouthcon.org. Go there to get the full details. But Daisy and I will be doing panels, some workshops, and then we're performing together on the Masquerade Saturday night, the 19th. That's the intermission. That's their cosplay contest. We're we're covering the intermission while the judges deliberate, and we'll have a few other people with us. But come hear Daisy Ukulele and sing some hot Red Hot Mama tunes. It's going to be a lot of fun. And I'll be there as Big Daddy Cool that night. So I'll be laying down a smoking groove so cool it'll make you flip your lid. Can you dig that? I knew that you could. All right, well, that's it for the Agent Carter Roundtable. Woohoo! Great season, guys. On behalf of Ken Sharkey Braden, Larry Amiet, Charles Cornell, and Daisy O'Dare, this is John Pica, the artist also known as Big Daddy Cool, Johnny Della Rocca, telling you to swing hard, swing often, and we'll catch you on the flip side.